Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program.
At first glance, some of the symptoms of Williams syndrome sound like a dream come true. People who have it are astonishingly empathetic, openly affectionate, they're wonderful storytellers, and biologically incapable of distrusting people. They literally never meet a stranger, but that's a serious problem. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. The thing is, the mild hesitation and occasional fear the rest of us feel when we encounter strangers is protective. We are safer if we can make good guesses about who can't be trusted. People with Williams syndrome don't have that innate Geiger counter, which can leave them vulnerable to abuse and ironically can make it hard for them to form the close relationships they crave even more than the rest of us. Journalist Jennifer Latson explains in her book, The Boy Who Loved Too Much, The True Story of Pathological Friendliness. She joins us this hour from the studios of KUHF in Houston. Jennifer, welcome to Think.
Thank you.
You said when you first learned about Williams syndrome as an introvert, you thought it sounded almost enviable.
Absolutely. When I first heard about Williams, which was actually in an NPR story in 2010, I thought, this is not even, why is this called a disorder? I want some of this. So that was part of the reason that I wanted to write the book, was to figure out how does this work and how can I be more like them.
There are some serious medical complications that come along with it.
Exactly. And that's what I found out as I did more research, is not only are there some really serious health symptoms, including a potentially deadly heart defect that's common in Williams, there's also intellectual disability around what people with Down syndrome typically have. So there's a lot of drawbacks to the disorder besides the personality. But even the personality is kind of dangerous in itself, because like you mentioned, there's no sense of self-preservation or this person might be out to do me harm. And so they just sort of run up to everyone with open arms.
I'm fascinated by the way people with Williams syndrome tend to have a particular facility with language on the one hand and some communication and cognitive challenges on the other. So they're these great storytellers, but they can struggle to answer pretty basic questions correctly.
Exactly. They have kind of a way of making you think that they're really not intellectually disabled when you first meet them, just because their banter is so good and they're really quick with small talk. And I think they also kind of win you over by complimenting most people and telling them how excited they are to see them. And so it's hard to see that they're actually limited in some ways. But when you really ask them pointed questions, when you start going a little deeper than the small talk level, you start to realize where the gaps are.
How did scientists first identify Williams syndrome?
It was identified in 1961 by a New Zealand cardiologist named Williams. And he was noticing that a few of his patients who had this rare heart condition, it's called supravalvular aortic stenosis. It's very rare in the general population, but very common in the Williams population. And so he had some children in his clinic, and he noticed, well, they also have other things in common. So this outgoing, warm personality and a distinct set of facial features, which are described as elfin. So it includes upturned noses, pointy chins, prominent ears, high cheekbones, wide smiles. And it's kind of what you would think of when you open a fairy tale about elves. That's kind of what the illustration looks like. So originally it was actually called elfin face syndrome, and then eventually it became known as Williams syndrome.
You think it's possible that the mythology of elves might have been related to ancient cases of Williams syndrome?
I do. Yeah, that's something that I mentioned in the book, that some folklorists have said these real-life people with Williams, before we had any understanding of modern medicine and genetics, might have been the models for fairy tale elves, because not only do they physically resemble each other, but elves are very nice and they tend to help people and they're very musical and very charming. So there's a lot of overlap that makes some people think, well, this might be just a way of explaining these people who are so different and how they came to be here.
And in fact, some people with Williams, despite their cognitive challenges, are musically gifted.
Yes. A certain number are considered musical savants. It's at first, it seemed like it might have been a higher rate than the general population. And then there have been some more studies done that found really they're not more likely to be savants than anyone else. But the fact that they tend to be musically gifted in addition to their intellectual disability, is still pretty impressive. And even those who don't have, a lot of them have perfect pitch, and some people can pick up an instrument and just learn to play it by ear. But even if they don't have that, almost everyone with Williams has a very strong emotional reaction to music, and it's a lot more noticeable than what people in the general public have. So even young children with Williams who aren't talking yet will have these really profound emotional reactions to, you know, if a sad song plays, they'll go from happy to crying in an instant. And then if an upbeat song plays, they'll start dancing. So they're very affected by music, and that's actually been shown in some neuroimaging studies too, that their brains just light up more, and they light up in different parts of the brain than the rest of us.
When did scientists recognize the relationship between Williams syndrome and the number of genes present on chromosome 7?
That was in the mid-90s that they identified the exact 26 genes that are missing from chromosome 7. And because that's such a small number compared to the 20,000 genes that we have as humans, it's called a microdeletion. And it was kind of a groundbreaking advance for geneticists who were working on mapping the genome at the time, because it's such a small number of genes that have such a big impact and an observable impact, and kind of a strange pattern of symptoms. So everything from the musicality and the verbal abilities to some problems with spatial perception and depth perception, just all clustered on this very small unit of genes.
And this genetic anomaly seems to occur pretty randomly across the population, or can Williams syndrome run in families?
Well, it's a random, the genetic deletion itself is random, and there's really no demographic trends with it. So it's common among all culture, it's equally common, not common, but it's about 1 in 10,000 people who have this among all cultures. It doesn't matter if you're an older parent, it doesn't matter your ethnic background or anything like that. So, but once you have the deletion, then it can be passed down. So someone with Williams syndrome has a 50% chance of passing it down if they have children.
This book really, at its heart, is the story of a boy and his mother, Eli D'Angelo and Gail. You call them, you use pseudonyms for both of them, we should say. But
yes.
Tell us about the first time that you met Eli.
I met him in the winter of 2011, and I had met Gail earlier at a Williams syndrome event. And it was at the time that I was kind of looking for somebody to focus the book on, because I really wanted to tell one family's story and have that be kind of the lens that I examined Williams syndrome through. And I knew I wanted somebody who was around Eli's age, which was 12 when I met him, and I wanted to explore that coming of age and sort of the difficult period between childhood and adulthood, and how do you achieve adulthood and independence with a disorder like this. And so I showed up at their house, and Eli knew I was coming, but he gets so excited when he knows that there's a new person coming over that Gail didn't tell him until like the last possible moment. And then he was just beside himself, and he was waiting for me at the window. As soon as he saw me get out of my car, he ran out and opened the door and just shouted into the parking lot like, "Hello." And I walked in, and he hugged me several times, and he just he's so just busy all the time. He's kind of frenetic. And so he was just sort of kind of running circles around me and asking me questions. And he has a kind of a standard greeting routine that he does. Mm-hmm. So if he meets you for the first time, he'll usually compliment an article of clothing. So he says, "I like your shirt. Do you have a dog? Where's your dad?" So he kind of went through his list, and he didn't really wait for my answers very long. He's just trying to kind of make that connection as fast as possible.
You know, I mean this with absolutely no disrespect, but that description of him like asking you these friendly, very sweet questions and just being so happy to see you, it actually reminded me a little bit of the character that Will Ferrell played in the movie Elf, with this kind of, you know, irrepressible friendliness and generosity of spirit. I thought about that, but I didn't. Obviously, you're not playing this for laughs, but it's hard not to be charmed by Eli when you meet him.
Oh, my gosh. Well, he is so funny and charming. And, you know, he kind of plays it for laughs. I mean, he knows when he's being adorable, I think. So, yeah, so it's very fun to hang out with him. And a lot of the people that I met with Williams, you know, it's just, like, amazing to be around them. It's so fun.
You note a doctor who has studied Williams at a conference talked about what the rest of us must seem like to people with Williams syndrome. Like, we've got all these issues and we're always cranky and we don't like everybody. When you think about Williams from that perspective, it sort of turns it on its head.
Yes, exactly. And that was her point. She coined this new diagnosis for a disorder called Truss syndrome, T-R-O-U-S, the rest of us syndrome. And she was explaining to these parents whose kids had been newly diagnosed, and, you know, it's an awful blow to find out your kid has Williams syndrome, because, of course, they are lovely and charming and endearing, but there's so many challenges ahead for them. So these were some very sad-looking parents who just found this out, and she was saying, well, you know, I want to tell you a little bit about Truss syndrome. And, you know, people who have this syndrome are pathologically incapable of expressing affection. And, you know, they might hug you only once or twice a day. They might not say I love you at the end of every sentence. So to people with Williams, I definitely can see how we are the ones with the problem. And it does seem like it's the burden is on us a little bit to shift how we are rather than to force them to be more like us.
Eli's mom realized pretty early on that something was not right with her baby boy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, from the time he was, you know, 8-10 months old, he was having a lot of problems. He was diagnosed with failure to thrive. He was just not gaining weight. He was colicky. He cried a lot. And he wasn't hitting the milestones that she had some friends who had babies at the exact same time. And everybody else was hitting these milestones. And he, you know, was kind of barely moving. He wasn't learning to crawl at the time when other babies were learning to walk. And so she was really worried, but her pediatrician had no idea. You know, he was kind of treating each symptom individually. So, you know, he was treating his acid reflux and, you know, he was worried about the missing growth milestones, but he didn't know what to do. And then finally, a woman in the daycare center that Eli went to, she happened to be a geneticist, and she knew what Williams syndrome was and recognized the facial features and had heard that Gail was wondering what was wrong. And so she mentioned to Gail, you should probably get a genetic test done.
And Gail was, as any parent would be, just devastated by the diagnosis. And the biggest blow for her was the potential for cognitive disability.
Exactly. And that, she said, that was the most heartbreaking part, the one that really just drove her into a deep sadness, because it closed so many doors for him. So, you know, when he was born, she didn't know what he would become. She didn't have specific hopes that he would become a doctor or the president, but those weren't, you know, out of the running. So all of these possibilities that she had imagined and this fulfilling life that she hoped her son would have, she had to start rethinking that. And she describes kind of her coming to terms with the diagnosis as sort of step by step making her peace with what was possible and what his future could be like.
My guest is journalist Jennifer Latson. We're talking about her new book, The Boy Who Loved Too Much, A True Story of Pathological Friendliness. It's about Eli, a boy diagnosed with Williams syndrome. We'll talk more about this condition, sometimes referred to as the opposite of autism, not clinically, but in terms of some of its symptoms. If you would like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find us on Twitter. We are at @KERAThink.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, where students can pursue their passion. You can study social justice and build activism skills with fall courses like The Black Struggle for Freedom. Applications are available at smu.edu/mls.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist Jennifer Latson. We're talking about her new book, The Boy Who Loved Too Much, a true story of pathological friendliness. If you'd like to join our conversation about Williams syndrome, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Jennifer, Eli has a particular fascination with vacuum cleaners and floor scrubbers.
Yes.
And how did this come about?
You know, it's not uncommon among Williams, people with Williams syndrome. And we went to a summer camp. I shadowed him and his mom, and we went on this road trip to Michigan for a summer camp just for people with Williams. And when we got there, Eli started doing what he always does, which is pretend to vacuum or scrub a floor and just kind of make the noises with his own his own self. And one of the other mothers said, oh, yes, he has the vacuum fascination. And, you know, last year there were some vacuums just out in the common areas and we had to hide them in a closet or you would just find all the campers swarming around these vacuum cleaners. So he is really obsessed with one particular kind of floor scrubber, which is the Tennant 5400, and that is his favorite model. And a lot of it for him is kind of an auditory fixation. Mm-hmm. So he just really likes the sound of this motor whirring and kind of the gurgling, sudsy sound as it cleans the floor. So he'll watch YouTube videos over and over of people scrubbing floors with this floor scrubber.
I was really moved when you write about Gail. You know, initially she resisted the idea that Eli might not grow up to have the kind of job that she had hoped he would have someday. You know, as time has gone by, she's thought, wow, if he could work as a custodian somewhere or an assistant custodian, that would be fantastic. She's not absolutely sure that he will ever be able to live independently and have a, quote, regular job.
Right. Right. That was part of her adjustment process. Is at first she had to make peace with, okay, he's not probably going to be a brain surgeon, and that's okay as long as he can find something fulfilling to do. And she originally thought, well, he can't be a custodian. I want so much more than that for him. But watching him just light up around these cleaning implements, she thought, okay, well, if that's what's going to make him happy, that would be great. So she kind of went from resisting that idea to totally embracing it and then worrying, like you said, that maybe he doesn't have the focus, the physical ability, the self-discipline to really do that job because, you know, having to stick with it and clean a whole gym floor or warehouse floor, that might be more than he can handle. So now it's sort of a kind of a dream for her.
I want to talk about the hugging, because people with Williams syndrome are very affectionate. They have almost an urge, I guess it is an urge, to hug people that they haven't met yet. This might be adorable in a 5 or 6 year old. And Gail worries a lot that in a grown man, if Levi is still doing this, it could lead to really unpleasant consequences.
Right. And that was sort of the central struggle of the 3 years that I followed them from the time he was 12 to 15, because he was, really a child when I met him. And then he hit puberty. He got bigger. He's a full grown man. And yeah, it's a lot less adorable when he comes barreling towards you with open arms and say you're a woman standing alone somewhere and you don't know who he is or why he's doing this. So that was Gail's great fear. And she had heard from other people in the Williams community that it can be a problem. And there was one person she had heard about who their adult son hugged a woman at a bus stop at night, and she called the police. And luckily his parents were nearby and they were able to defuse the situation and explain, you know, what Williams syndrome is and why he did this, and he's not trying to threaten anyone. But it's a real concern that as you get older, if you are going to be independent, you need to know not to hug everyone.
So Gail is now raising Eli as a single parent. You don't share the details in the book. I guess she didn't want to share them. She doesn't think that the divorce had anything to do with the Williams syndrome, but she's a single parent. And she's really kind of given over her whole life to caring for her son in ways that maybe aren't healthy for her all the time.
Yeah, exactly. And that was part of her journey, I think, during those few years, is starting to realize, you know, the fact that she devotes everything to him is maybe actually not good for either of them, because she's doing so much for him that he doesn't have a chance to to test whether or not he could be independent. Could he be doing these things for himself? And like you said, she doesn't really have much of a social life outside of things she does with Eli, taking him to Williams Syndrome events and his special needs sports leagues and all the things she does for him. So I would say she tentatively began to try to correct that. But he is so high maintenance that if he's going to live with her indefinitely, which she thinks he is, there's not that much that she can do apart from him.
He also, as he's gotten older, as loving as he can be, he has struggled at times with tantrums, with rage when he doesn't get his way. And these have started to be a real problem on the occasions that they happen.
Right. And it's so jarring when it happens, because 90% of the time he's so joyful and so grateful. And he's the only teenage boy that I've ever come across who tells his mom how much he loves her multiple times in a day. And, you know, half of the conversations that I would overhear at their house would end with, you know, "You're the best, mom. You're so great. You're so beautiful." So it's so nice. But then I think because he's physically a teenager, even though I think mentally in a lot of ways he is more like a toddler, he's going through the same physical changes and hormonal changes that we all do in adolescence. And so he has angst, and he doesn't really know how to articulate it or what to do with it. And so he kind of responds in a toddler-like way, and he just has these meltdowns, and sometimes they are violent. And I think for Gail, it was just, what do I do with this? And how do I handle a son who's as big as me or bigger than me eventually? And, you know, he's physically lashing out.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Francisco in Houston. Hi, Francisco.
Hey, hi, how are you doing?
Very well, thanks.
I just wanted to share that my sister, she passed away about 3 years ago. And you know, she had Williams Syndrome, and she was such a blessing for our family. We small children growing with her. She was at times just the center of the family and friends, and everybody knew her in Chihuahua, where I'm from, Chihuahua, Mexico. And she was so popular and so loving, and it was just a wonderful, wonderful life experience for all of us, and we felt always very, very blessed. And we came to be Marisa's, that was her name, Marisa's brother, Marisa's sisters, Marisa's parents. So she was the one who everybody knew and everybody loved. And even when I go back to Chihuahua, you know, Marisa would be in the center of all the conversation. So, and when she got older, she was 49 when she passed away. And when she got older, she got to mature and to be more controlled. She, at the beginning, when we were kids, we had to stop her. Don't kiss that person, or don't kiss. He's not your uncle. She's not your aunt. So we were always, you know, very close to her, trying to stop her from, you know, getting embarrassed or getting, you know, pushed away from people that she didn't know. But as she got older, she kind of understood that wasn't the way to behave.
Well, Francisco, thank you so much for sharing that story. I'm sorry that you lost your sister at such a young age, but she sounds like just a wonderful person. And Jennifer, I know that you've met some other adults with Williams Syndrome, and there are some who do, in fact, do better as they get older. They sort of learn the rules. Maybe it takes longer than it does for the average person.
Right, and there's some really high-functioning people with Williams. There's a very wide spectrum, even though they're all missing the same 26 genes. There's an amazing variability in how these different symptoms affect people. So even though the average IQ for someone with Williams is in the 50s, there are some people who have a nearly normal or normal IQ, but then they will still usually have some of the other symptoms. So they might have some of the health effects, or, you know, still have some of the social effects, even though they, you know, have the intellectual ability to know, okay, I shouldn't be hugging people. I have to keep reminding myself to stand back and give them their space. So there was one woman that I spent some time with who is in her 30s, and she lives semi-independently, and she lives in an apartment building that's run by the Department of Social Services. So there's staff on site, but she has her own apartment with a roommate, and they're, you know, responsible for their cooking and their cleaning, and she works part-time. She takes a bus to work. So she's kind of on her own, and she does really well, but there are some limitations that she's always aware of because she has those spatial problems. She knows she'll never be able to drive a car, and she gets lost really easily just because she has no idea how to orient herself back to where she started from.
The spatial problems even go so far as to make it challenging for some people with Williams syndrome to be able to say, put the apple on the table, I pulled the sweater out of the bag, to use those words correctly.
Yeah, that is one of the strange things about, despite their kind of linguistic gifts, there are some grammatical problem. I mean, I guess that's more of a preposition problem, is they can't figure out in, around, outside. So it's really been interesting to, there's so many different kinds of scientists who've studied Williams just because it illuminates so much. So apart from the geneticists, there's linguists who study, okay, what does that say about the brain processing language that, you know, this part of their linguistic ability seems to be perfectly fine and this part seems to be so limited.
I want to talk about this description that it's like the opposite of autism. That doesn't necessarily mean from a clinical sense, but when you look at the symptoms, some of them seem to stack up as in the same category, but with a very different outcome.
Exactly. So the social symptoms seem like they're direct opposites because, you know, people with Williams almost make too much eye contact. They get too close to people. They smile at everyone. And so in that way, it seems like the opposite of autism. But on the other hand, they even have some of the same social problems as people with autism, like perseveration and just kind of saying the same phrases over and over is a problem for them. Or like in Eli's case and many other people, they will talk about only the topics that interest them, which includes floor scrubbers and vacuum cleaners, and maybe go on a really long tirade about what kind of floor scrubber is the best, all the different models of vacuum cleaner that exist. And so that can really alienate people. So they end up having a similar problem getting to establish friendships that people with autism have. It's just that they start from kind of the opposite direction.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist Jennifer Latson. Her book is called The Boy Who Loved Too Much, A True Story of Pathological Friendliness. We'll go back to the phones now and this time speak with Nancy in Houston. Hi, Nancy.
Hello. I was I just have so much I would like to say. My son was born in 1972. We knew immediately that something was wrong. He slept too much. Never cried, and we had children 8 and 11, so we knew the difference. And they would find little things wrong with him. They tested him, the hypercalcemia syndrome, they thought maybe. He would just have bits and pieces of stuff. He taught himself to read at 5 years old. He started in a DMR program at a public school. And she called that day and said, he's bringing books home in his backpack. Be sure to have him show you. And at that age, we laid in the living room floor, all of us, and he could read all of those books. We don't know how he learned to read.
That's really remarkable, Nancy. Thank you so much for sharing that story. And Jennifer, as you said, there's a wide spectrum of cognitive ability or disability in the Williams community.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So some people just have remarkable skills, and it's always different kind of how each symptom will show up. So some people even have, you know, you can't tell from looking at them facially that they have Williams syndrome, but they might have some of the other symptoms more profoundly. There's also something called an atypical deletion, and that's, you know, rare, even within this rare group of Williams syndrome, that people might be missing some of the 26 genes, but not all of them. And those people are in high demand among geneticists, because if you can take one or two genes out of the function and figure out what symptoms aren't showing up anymore, then it really helps them isolate what the genes are doing. So there was one girl that I mentioned in the book who geneticists were really interested in, because she was missing every gene but one on the Williams spectrum, and she seemed to have normal social skills. So she wasn't running up to strangers, she wasn't smothering people with affection, she was having more sophisticated kind of conversations than most people with Williams. And so they really zeroed in on this one gene, which it turns out helps regulate the production of a hormone called oxytocin. And a lot of people have already studied oxytocin, because it does play a role in attachment and bonding, and it's what's released when new mothers are nursing their babies. So it's something that really helps cement human relationships. And what they found was people with Williams are not getting the same kind of regulated, carefully released doses of oxytocin that most of us get. They have oxytocin flooding their brains kind of all the time, and they have a baseline level of oxytocin. It's about three times higher than the rest of ours. So that really seems like it plays a big role in that social component of the disorder.
Would anybody try to limit the amount of oxytocin being produced in the brain or for the brain of a person with Williams syndrome?
I think that is something that they're definitely exploring, and how they could do that. It's also really interesting because apart from the Williams community, which is such a rare part of the population, it could be enormously useful for people who have other neurological type disorders like autism or things that affect social activity in a different way.
We're speaking with writer Jennifer Latson about her new book, The Boy Who Loved Too Much, A True Story of Pathological Friendliness. We're talking about Williams Syndrome. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372, email think@kera.org, or find us on Twitter. We're @KERAThink.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program for working adults interested in human-centered leadership. You can take courses this fall, like Personhood in the Age of Corporate Enterprise. Applications are available at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking with journalist Jennifer Latson about her new book, The Boy Who Loved Too Much, A True Story of Pathological Friendliness. If you'd like to join our conversation about Williams Syndrome, you can call 1-800-933-5372. Jennifer, it's not often that I tear up when I'm combing through my stack of nonfiction books for the show, but there's a scene where, you know, Gail has worried Eli's whole life that he would be bullied. And at one point she learned that a science class in his school was studying genetics, and they said, "We're going to look at Williams syndrome. Will you come and talk about what it is?" And at first she didn't want to.
Right. I think she and I had that in common, that we both thought, okay, people are going to just reject this kid when he comes at them with unfettered, you know, desire for connection. And she was sort of worried that every day when he goes to school, are people teasing him? Are they making him the butt of jokes? And because he doesn't really have the sophistication to know when he's on the wrong end of a joke, or if people are laughing at him, not with him. So she was worried. I mean, this was middle school, and middle school kids are real mean. So she just thought, oh, my highly vulnerable kid is just out there kind of exposed to these horrible other kids. And what she found out was she went to this science class, and all of his peers were asking these really thoughtful questions that reflected an earnest interest in his well-being and kind of a curiosity of, well, why does he do this? Why is he like that? And they all told her some of their favorite anecdotes of things that he's done that they appreciated genuinely, not in a laughing way, but he would do a lot of musical performances, sort of impromptu in the cafeteria. He sang some Lady Gaga songs that everyone really thought was great. And so they were all telling Gail this, and she could just feel that they really care about him. So that was kind of a turning point for her is, oh, I don't have to protect him from these kids. They are drawn to him. I mean, his kindness and the way he is kind of brings out the kindness in other people.
So she's dealing with that thing that, you know, parents of middle schoolers and teenagers do the world over, even with neurotypical kids, which is deciding when to let him struggle a little bit and when to swoop in and solve or prevent a problem for him.
Exactly. And there was a point where things were hard enough in middle school with his own behavior and the tantrums that he was having. And she thought, gosh, when he goes to high school and all these other kids are well on their way to adulthood, he's going to stick out and he's going to be a black sheep. And she contemplated maybe pulling him out of the public school and putting him in a school just for kids with special needs, thinking that she would be protecting him. And she had an advocate who works with her when they go in for their public school meetings to set their goals for the year. And the advocate was saying, Gail, this is not the 1950s. You don't have to hide him from the world. Hmm. And that was a real blow for her because she thought, well, am I doing this for him or for me? Like, I'm not trying to hide him. I'm trying to protect his dignity. But then she realized, no, he's a very social kid and he deserves to be around people and kind of see the world as it is. So if there's a chance that he will get made fun of, well, that's just, we all have that risk. So she decided to keep him in the public school.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Sally in Fort Worth. Hi, Sally.
Hi,
go right ahead, please.
Okay, so I had a question about the, like, medical aspects of Williams. I have a nephew that we know there's something, and we've taken him to the doctor trying to figure it out. And a lot of, what I'm hearing on your podcast rings very true for him. The only thing that I've really got a question about is maybe what, like, the physical symptoms might be out of those 26 missing chromosomes. His big thing is his stomach. He's always constipated. He takes Metamucil every day. His breakfast, he has special pancakes that he has every morning, and they're full of fiber. So,
well, are digestive problems common to people with Williams?
They are, actually. That's a big part of the syndrome. Eli has pretty bad digestive problems, and they've done similar things. So I will say the great thing about Williams is that there's a simple blood test for it, and so that's what makes it different from autism, which has no known genetic cause, is that they can do what's called a FISH test, and they can immediately find out whether, with 100% certainty.
All right, let's go back to the phones this time. Marla is on the line in Houston. Hi, Marla.
Hi, this is a very interesting program. Thank you. And not a lot of people know about Williams. My cousin, who recently died, he was only in his 30s, had it, although it was never officially confirmed. My uncle just sort of washed his hands of it and has just sort of let it all fall apart after my aunt died. And I was just wondering what the long-term issues of health were for individuals with Williams, which is one of the reasons we wanted my uncle to, like, look into it more because, with Down syndrome, those babies often have heart defects, and I was just curious about, the overall health issues associated with it. Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
Yeah, thanks. The heart issues for Williams are probably the biggest danger, and with the stenosis that I mentioned, which is kind of a narrowing and a rigidity of the aorta, it can get worse at any time. And so it's one of the reasons that a lot of really young kids with Williams don't make it out of childhood, because it can be deadly right away. And then a lot of other children have heart surgery really early to try to correct it. So that's usually what I hear about for people who've died suddenly or died very young with Williams. But there's no reason that someone with Williams necessarily should have a shorter lifespan overall. It's just that a lot of people who have this severe heart defect do succumb to it.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next on the phone to Caleb in Austin. Hey, Caleb.
Hi. Thank you for this wonderful discussion. I worked in at a school in England, Coney Hall, in Coney Hall called Nash College, where they would put lots of different, you know, people with mental and physical disabilities in one on top of a hill of all things. And I want to commend, you know, her for sticking Eli into the public schools. I think that's amazing. I worked with a couple of students with Williams syndrome, one-on-one, and the other, they loved Henry the Hoover, so the vacuum cleaner rings very true. But what I was asking was, one of my students that I was one-on-one with loved music programs, and you mentioned that Eli would get up and perform Lady Gaga, and I really saw this student that I worked with really excel, and he would play the piano, and we would go into the music room, and I was wondering if that is something that, you know, are Williams syndrome, do they really excel in music?
Yeah, a lot of them do, and this summer camp that I mentioned earlier that we went to just for kids with Williams syndrome was a music therapy camp, and music therapy is a huge part of treatment for Williams because not only do they tend to be gifted at music, they also just are really more deeply affected by it, and they tend to remember lessons that are set to music really clearly, and so it's really helpful, but it's such a big part of Eli's life that I felt like I couldn't even convey enough in the book how much he's constantly singing. When he's not talking, he's just kind of singing in the background, and Gail is so used to it, she just talks over it at this point. But he has certain performers that he really favors, although I couldn't always tell what the connection was, but he loves Pavarotti, he loves Meatloaf, he loves Alice Cooper.
He likes drama, I guess.
Exactly. Somebody with a lot of stage presence and a lot of, yeah, vocal drama. And he would listen to these YouTube videos and practice the exact intonation and the way that Meatloaf and or Pavarotti delivers this line. So, yeah, he could do it pretty well.
I don't know how either one of them would feel about being in the same sentence together, but hopefully they would be flattered.
Yeah.
In terms of his media consumption, he's still childlike in some ways, like a big fan of Cookie Monster.
Mm-hmm.
But then he's also asking questions about like when he can go on a date. So how is Gail managing talking to him about the ways his body is changing physically and the way his interest in women might be developing?
Luckily, she's very candid, and he's very candid. I mean, he's the only teenage boy I know that tells his mom exactly what he's thinking and feeling, and she explains what that means. And so, you know, I think it's a little difficult for her just because there's really not a lot of male figures in his life that he can go to. His dad's really not in the picture. Gail's mom is really involved with their family, but her dad has passed, and so... and obviously he's an only child, so there's no male siblings. So it kind of comes down to this community of women to help him through kind of the awkward time that we all go through in middle and high school.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Back to the phones now at 800-933-5372. We have Terry on the line in San Antonio. Hi, Terry.
Hi. I have a 9-year-old. He does not have... you know, any kind of developmental problems, but socially, he is extremely, you know, friendly and loving to everyone. He's been that way since, you know, against all of the developmental stages where children don't share, he shared, things of that nature. He's had some of the physical symptoms as well, and I was just wondering, when you mentioned that, similar to autism, this can be, you know, there's a very wide spectrum. Mm-hmm. If you had it in a small degree, is that something the blood test could detect? And what are kind of the preliminary things that would prompt a test?
Well, I mean, usually what ends up getting doctors to run a test is are these cardiac issues. And so in Eli's case, he didn't have a very severe manifestation of those issues. So it just happened to be that his facial features were recognized by someone who knew what Williams was. So I think anyone could ask their doctor to run the test and, you know, you'd know for sure one way or the other. But yeah, there is a wide spectrum. So it's not always obvious that two kids who have Williams syndrome, they won't necessarily be exactly alike.
For kids who might be a little more, who might more obviously manifest social problems, cognitive challenges, it must be hard for families of people with Williams syndrome because it's not well known, right? Like nowadays, I think if you say, oh, my daughter has autism or my son has Down syndrome, most people know what that means. Williams syndrome isn't a household word.
It's not, and it's so far from being a household word that there are still people who don't get diagnosed, even though, you know, if you read through all their symptoms and you knew what Williams was, you would say, okay, well, this might be a textbook case. But there are some pediatricians who just don't think to test for it, and it's so rare that it's not among the typical prenatal testing that gets done. So you might know if you were carrying a child with Down syndrome, but you wouldn't know if you were going to carry a child with Williams syndrome. So yeah, there are still some people who have made it really late in life before finding out that they had Williams syndrome. And there's probably some that never found out. But there was a woman that I wrote about who was in her 80s when she got diagnosed, and her whole life she had had these classic Williams symptoms, and she hugged everyone and she was very musical. And it was so obvious once she joined kind of the Williams community, it was like, oh, you're one of us. But, you know, if you don't see other people with Williams or you're not a geneticist, you might not know.
So how old is Eli? 17 today? 18?
He's 18. Yep. He just graduated from high school.
What's he doing?
Well, now he's just taking it easy for the summer. And because he has special needs, his public school education will actually run for 3 more years. And so those will be life skills training. So he won't actually still be in the high school. He'll be in a separate kind of program. But he'll be learning some vocational training and some sort of basic life skills. And so he'll still get that kind of structured social setting for a few more years.
And you've seen him grow a lot over those years.
Yeah. I was astonished to see how far he came, because when I started with this family, I joined them sort of right before puberty hit. Mm-hmm. And then it was this, you know, he was just this adorable child. And then it was this kind of emotional roller coaster for a few years. And now he's matured more than I thought he would. And he's come so far. And Gail, too, says, you know, he's doing things that I never thought he'd be able to do. And it's a lot better than it looked 3 years ago.
The new book by journalist Jennifer Latson is called The Boy Who Loved Too Much, A True Story of Pathological Friendliness. Jennifer, it's been really interesting. Thank you very much for making time for us today.
Thank you so much.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker. Shelley Canavy is our technical director. Samantha Guzman is associate producer. And Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can follow us on Facebook and on Twitter. Our Twitter handle is at KERAThink. Mine is at Chris Boyd Think. You can subscribe to the podcast and learn more about the show at think.kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.